Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiya, Bummy Walthamstall here. Star of reality TV shows, like Thick Twats on an Island Dicking About. D-list nobody's getting dodgy facelifts. And ooh yeah, I'll eat a kangaroo's bollock if it'll make me famous. I had that catchphrase, remember? I'm not all there, am I? Ah, shit a brick. No one chuffin' remembers Bobby Walthamstall. I were all the rage one hot minute ago. Tabloids were all obsessed with how fat or thin me ass was. Every page was full of shots of me passed out, cock out and spewing. And I had no discernible skills, just a single brain cell firing just long enough for me to utter my catchphrase. But now, everybody's sick of the sight of me. 1 year on, me career's gone, me agent sacked me. Well, me mum and Auntie Barbara. I lost all of me sponsors. Yeah, I'm no longer the grinning git tapping his arse in Asda. The boss-eyed bugger eating a pasty in Poundland. Or the face that you'd love to slap on a packet of Angel Delight. No, not the good one, the shite one from Lidl. No, it's all gone, now that the telly's full of low-rent tossers like Freddie Scunthorpe.
Look at me, I'm a right bellend.
Sassy McFlaps. Oh, me tits have popped out. Again? And pouty Philomena Quinoa Falafel. And her catchphrase. As no one can understand a bloody word she says because of all the chuffing lip implants she's had. So now, I've sunk so low, I'm having to do an advert for Murder Mile. I know. So here goes. Buy some Murder Mile mugs. So says me, Bobby Walthamstall. I'm not all there, am I? Ha ha ha, ha 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 ha. Somebody kill me now. Hang on. Podcasting. I could do that. Oh, it's dead easy. It's just talking shite. That's it. I'm setting up my own true crime podcast. Yeah. Listen up, people. I, Bobby Walthamstall, star of reality TV shows like Stuck in a House with Five Right Twats, Ruining Cakes with Other Numpties, and Getting a TV Doc to Examine Me Cock, announce right now that my true crime podcast is coming to an ear near you.
Oh, dear God, help us all. And before Bobby's podcast monstrosity is launched, just to say, I've ordered a load more Murder Mile mugs and goodies available via the Murder Mile merch shop, which will make a lovely Christmas treat, obviously. And as there's only a few more weeks until the new Murder Mile multi-part series slops into your bonts, before that, there's this. Friends, welcome to Mini Mile, your indispensable compendium of UK true crime trivia. This week, we'll ask, what is the average killing spree of a serial killer? What can forensics teams determine from different patterns of blood? Can you sustain a normal sex life in prison? We read another mundane letter from an infamous serial killer. And we meet a very naughty priest who needs to spend a serious amount of time in confession. And with only a few weeks until the brand new Murder Mile multi-part series, here's this week's episode of Mini Mile. Let's kick things off with a little How Do You Do? By learning more about some infamous murderers and serial killers on a more social level. This week, killing sprees. How long do most serial killers last? To work this out, I've chosen 50 serial killers, spree killers and murderers at random from the UK, US and other countries. This is a biggie, so strap in. Number 1. Aileen Wuornos, the US serial killer and abused sex worker. She lasted just shy of 1 year, and she was between 33 and 34 years old. Number 2. Albert DeSalvo, the Boston Strangler.
Hey, I'm the Boston Strangler. How are ya?
It's meant to be a Boston accent. It sounded Australian. He lasted 1 year and 7 months and was between 31 and 33 years old during the murders. Number 3. Albert Fish, the child killer, cannibal and sadistic paedophile. His later murders are currently and still disputed. So he either lasted 3 years and 11 months or 8 years, 5 months, meaning his murders occurred when he was either 54 to 58 years old or 54 to 62 years old. Number 4. Anthony Hardy, the sadistic and twisted Camden Ripper from Old London Town.
Cool, blow me, guv'nor.
I sound like Dick Van Dyke then. His lasted exactly 2 years, and he was 49 to 51 years old. Number 5. Beverly Allett, dubbed the Angel of Death. But only because journalists were too lazy to come up with a new nickname for her, as actually many serial killers or spree killers who were once nurses are often given this moniker, including Richard Angelo, Charles Cullen, Kristen Gilbert, Donald Harvey, Miyuki Ishikawa, SS Officer Joseph Mengele, Colin Norris, Robeldo Puch, and Jane Toppin, to name but a few. She lasted from the 21st of February 1991 to the 22nd of April 1991. That's 2 months, and she was 22 years old. Number 6. Colin Ireland, dubbed the Gay Slayer. He lasted just 3 months, but at the time of his killings, he was on the cusp of being 40. The big 4-0. Cynthia Kaufman. She lasted roughly 2 months when she was 24 years old. Number 8. David Berkowitz, the son of Sam. He lasted 1 year and 7 months when he was between 22 and 24 years old. Number 9. Dennis Nielsen. I'm the nice one. His killing spree of 15 to 16 victims and 8 or 9 who escaped lasted 4 years and 1 month when he was between 33 and 37 years old. Number 10. Dennis Radder, also known as BTK.
As they say, at BTK, you'll get it.
I think that's how the jingle went. He lasted 17 years, between the ages of 29 and 45 years old, but this was interrupted by a prison sentence. I'm guessing he was incarcerated because he spilt a certain police constable's Guinness. Right, let's speed through the next ones, as my cup of tea is going cold, and I'd hate for Reg Christie to feel an overwhelming need to make me another cup.
Would you like another cup of tea?
No, I'm okay with a tepid cup, Reg. Phew, lucky escape. Number 11. Donald Nielsen, the robber and murderer known as the Black Panther. He lasted 11 months. He was 37 to 38 years old. Number 12. Dorothy Puente. Her killing spree is estimated at 6 years. She was 53 to 59 years old. Number 13. Ed Gein, grave robber, taxidermist and murderer. His killing spree probably lasted 5 years, it is estimated, when he was 41 to 46 years old. Number 14. Edmund Kemper. His killing spree of 8 years and 8 months included a stretch in prison when he was between 15 and 24 years old. Number 15. Faye Copeland. Her spree lasted roughly 3 years when she was aged 72 to 75 years old. Number 16. Fred West, Gloucester's favourite plasterer. His killing spree lasted a whopping 19 years and 11 months. That included a short stint in prison. He was 26 years old when it started and 47 years old when he was arrested. Number 17. George Joseph Smith, the Brides in the Bath murderer. His spree lasted roughly 2 years when he was 40 to 42 years old. Number 18. Graham Young, the teacup poisoner. His spree lasted 8 years and 11 months, including prison time, when he was 14 to 23 years old. Number 19. H.H. Holmes, Chicago's infamous World's Fair killer. He lasted 7 years and 11 months. He was 25 to 33 years old. Number 20. Harold Shipman. Charged with 15 confirmed deaths, suspected of 257, and police are still investigating up to 450 murders. These are hard to prove, as being the doctor, he signed off the death certificate and had many of the bodies cremated. He lasted from 1975 to 1998, which is at least 23 years, and he was aged from 29 to 52 years old.
Mike, that tea's getting very cold. A bit like my wife. Are you sure you couldn't do with another brew? I'd hate for you to die of thirst.
No, really, Reg. I'm okay. Onward! 21. André Désiré Landru, the lady killer with a very natty moustache. He lasted 4 years, from January 1915 to January 1919. He was 45 to 49 years old. 22. Ian Brady, the Moors murderer. He lasted 2 years and 3 months. He was 25 to 27 years old. 23. Janie Lou Gibbs. She lasted roughly 2 years. She was 34 to 35 years old. 24.
Jeffrey Dahmer. Who cares? Oh my god, Jeffrey Dahmer. He's like my boyfriend.
Jeffrey Dahmer, the Milwaukee cannibal. He lasted 13 years and 1 month. He was between 18 and 31 years old. 25. Joel Rifkin, aka Joel the Ripper. His spree lasted roughly 4 years, from 1989 to 1993, when he was 30 to 34 years old. He is currently sentenced to 203 years in prison. Don't worry, Joel. By then, I'm sure that mobile phones will be really tiny. 26. John George Haig, the acid bath murderer. He lasted 4 years and 6 months. He was 34 to 39 years old. 27. John Reginald Christie, necrophile, serial killer, ladies' man, Ladbroke Grove stud, and tea maker extraordinaire. He lasted 9 years and 7 months. He was 44 to 53 years old. 28. John Wayne Gacy, the killer clown and KFC manager. He lasted 6 years and 11 months. He was 29 to 36 years old. 29. Kenneth Erskine, the Stockwell Strangler. He lasted just 3 months. He was between 22 and 23 years old. Number 30. Kristen Gilbert, one of the other Angels of Death. She lasted 7 years, including a stint in prison, when she was 22 to 29 years old. Right. Tea break. Oh dear, that's horrible.
If you like, I could heat it up a bit. Me hob's on the blink. But as all the ladies say, I've got warm hands. And other bits.
No, I'm fine, thank you, Reg. Cold tea is good for me. Right, let's crack on. 31. Levi Belfield, the bust-up killer. He lasted 2 years and 5 months, estimated because they're still looking at other killings he may have done, when he was 33 to 34 years old. 32. Michael Lupo, the Wolfman. Estimated at 5 years-ish, he was in his early to mid-30s. 33. Myra Hindley, the other Moors murderer. She lasted 2 years and 3 months. She was 19 to 23 years old. 34. Patrick McKay. He lasted 1 year and 1 month, and he was 21 to 22 years old. 35. Peter Manuel, the Beast of Birkinshaw. He lasted 2 years. He was 29 to 31 years old. 36. Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, who you might believe was probably a Brummie, if my letter-reading skills are anything to go by. He lasted 5 years and 1 month. He was 29 to 34 years old. 37. Peter Tobin, possibly the unsolved Bible John killer. He lasted 15 years and 7 months, although he is still suspected of many more murders, when he was 44 to 60 years old. 38. Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker. He lasted 1 year and 4 months, when he was 24 to 25 years old. 39. Robert Black, the Scottish serial killer and paedophile. He lasted 5 years and 7 months, when he was 34 to 38 years old. Number 40. Robert Maudsley, dubbed Hannibal the Cannibal by tabloid hacks who could never really be asked to do their research properly. He lasted 4 years when he was 21 to 25 years old.
Whew! Phew! Almost there! Right.
Oh, I see you've almost finished your tea. I wondered if you'd like a...
No tea, thank you, Reg. Why are you bothering me? I thought you only liked the ladies.
I do, but being dead, I'd go for anything, even a fat, bald man. And besides, I quite like that little wiggly worm which had a chomp on little Reg. Nom, nom, nom. Remember?
Well, sorry, Reg, but I'm on a diet.
Ah, shame.
41. Robert Napper, 1 year and 4 months, when he was 26 to 27 years old. Number 42. Rodney Alcala, aka the Dating Game Killer. He lasted roughly 8 years, when he was 27 to 36 years old. Number 43. Rose West.
Hot!
She lasted 15 years and 11 months, when she was 18 to 31 years old. Number 44. Stephen Griffiths, the self-styled crossbow cannibal. Even though he didn't own a crossbow, and he wasn't a cannibal. What a twat. He lasted 11 months, on the cusp and the turn of his 40th birthday. Number 45. Stephen Port, the grinder killer. He lasted 1 year and 3 months, although he is currently being investigated for many more murders, so this could definitely increase, when he was on the cusp of being 40 years old. Number 46. Steve Wright.
In the afternoon.
No, not that one. Stephen Wright, the Suffolk Strangler. He lasted just 5 weeks when he was 48 years old. Number 47. Stephen Grieveson, the Sunderland Strangler. He lasted 3 years and 9 months when he was 19 to 23 years old. Number 48. Ted Bundy, the crazy lady's favourite. He lasted 4 years when he was 28 to 31 years old, again on the cusp and the turn of being 30. Number 49. Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, or based on his nickname, it looks as if he bombed the co-star of Wurzel Gummidge, Una Stubbs. He lasted 15 years and 11 months when he was 36 to 52 years old. And finally, number 50, Trevor Hardy, the Beast of Manchester.
Manfred, you're all right, kid, Manfred.
He lasted 1 year and 9 months when he was 29 to 31 years old, again on the cusp of 30. So, a big applause to all of you there for surviving that list. I actually had to trim off quite a few of those names. The list was a lot bigger at the start, but even I was losing the will to live.
Oh, maybe you should reinvigorate yourself with a nice cup of tea.
Yeah, okay, go on then, Reg.
Oh, great. I'll just pop on the gas to, boil the water.
So, let's break this down. Who were the shortest? Well, these were the spree killers. Stephen Wright, who lasted 6 weeks, Beverly Allett and Cynthia Kaufman, who lasted 2 months, and Colin Ireland and Kenneth Erskine, who lasted 3 months. With the longest, excluding those who were incarcerated, being Jeffrey Dahmer at 13 years 1 month, Ted Kaczynski at 15 years 11 months, Fred and Rose West at 15 years 11 months, if you exclude Fred's prison time, and of course, at the top of the list is Harold Shipman. His killing spree was 23 years, this is estimated it could be a hell of a lot longer. As expected, most serial killers often last, on average, between a year to 2 years, and those figures tail off the longer their killing spree continues. Although the average across the board is said that female serial killers last 8 to 11 years, and only 2 years for men. I guess us guys finish early. I hear it's a common problem. But interestingly, although the bulk of those serial killers committed their crimes in their 20s, with some into their 30s, 6 actually committed their first murder in their teens. Graham Young was 14, Edmund Kemper was 15, Jeffrey Dahmer was 18, Rose West was 18, Myra Hindley was 19, and Stephen Grieveson was 19. With only 3 of those killers in their 50s,
Dorothea Puente, Albert Fish and Harold Chipman, and only two, the couple Faye and Ray Copeland in their 70s. But interestingly, quite a few of them were on the cusp of a significant birthday, usually their 20s or 30s. These were Trevor Hardy, Peter Manuel, Stephen Greaveson, Stephen Port and Anthony Hardy. Well, I guess some people celebrate with a party, whereas others go on a killing spree. Me, I'd prefer a nice cup of tea.
Tea's up, Mike.
Oh, thanks, Reg. I'll be right there.
How'd you take it? One lump or two?
Two. But please, don't ask me that while you're fiddling with yourself.
Sorry. Force a habit.
Ugh, creepy man. And now, as there's no extra mile in the mini-mile episodes...
Ah, what will I do? My life isn't complete without extra mile.
Here's a little nugget of extra mile to assuage your pangs. I'm not editing that out. All that. All that. And now, back to the show. Now, it's time to get technical.
Let's get technical! Technical!
And by technical, I don't mean technical like in an IKEA instruction manual, where a smiley cartoon shows you how easy it is to assemble a bog-standard Flügenhügenmügen bookcase in 10 easy steps, only for you to get stuck on step 1 when they ask you to put bolt 62 in slot F9A of piece Wibblety Thrixty, only to create a wonky monstrosity which is one board short, has 15 screws left and 3 bolts missing, so you end up hammering it together with nails that you had left over whilst erecting an IKEA sofa, a soap dish and a garlic press. But at least you got to buy some Swedish meatballs and some of those Deem bars. Mmm, yummy. So this week, let's say tatty bye and toodaloo to the bluster and blather of those CSI-style crime shows by asking, how does it work exactly? This week, blood pattern analysis. What can forensics tell from the pattern of blood at a crime scene? Also known as BPA, blood pattern analysis is an invaluable tool for any crime scene investigator. As although, as we saw in Mini Mile number 9, although you can semi-successfully clean up a crime scene, you can't tamper with the laws of physics. So by understanding at what speed, height, distance and angle the blood travels, and how it impacts with the surface, that can help an investigator to establish what crime took place, the sequence of events, the position of those involved, and to confirm or deny an eyewitness's, victim's and perpetrator's description of the events. There are three primary blood patterns. Number one, a single drop. A single drop of blood falling vertically and forming an evenly spread spherical shape shows that the victim was standing and motionless at the time that they bled, with the bloodstain being more teardrop-shaped the greater the victim moves in a certain direction. Although the higher the blood falls, the larger the stain should be, the width of the stain can't tell you what height it fell from, as this also depends on the quantity of the blood and the surface it fell onto, as absorbent surfaces, like carpet or clothing, create smaller stains, but flat or rough textured surfaces, like tile, wood or stone, can distort the shape and create its own spray, also known as satellite stains. Number 2. Impact spatter. When a victim is violently struck, the force of the blow results in the expulsion of blood droplets from the injury, at speed, from a height and at an angle. But as the blood droplets are propelled through the air, they will disperse into even smaller droplets and become more scattered the further they are propelled from the single point of impact. And as before, each droplet will land in a very specific way, from either a teardrop shape or a long thin streak, which tells you where the point of impact was. If the impact spatter is interrupted, this will show where a person
or an object was at that moment, as instead of blood droplets, the surface will be interrupted by a void. Number 3. Cast-off stains. These occur when a blood-stained object is cast aside. Just like when you shake off the rainwater from a soaked umbrella, the speed and angle of your wrist flicking off the excess water will produce a very distinctive pattern. If a perpetrator throws aside a bloodied knife, the excess blood cast off the object will produce a pattern of its very own, usually a linear or curved shape. And the smaller and less dense the impact spatter, the further away it was cast. Number 4. Transfer blood stains. This is when a bloodied surface comes into contact with a second surface, whether clothing, a person, or a weapon. It creates a very unnatural smear and smudge, which, unlike a single drop, impact spatter, or cast-off stain, is very unique, showing you what speed, height, and direction of transfer occurred. And like impact spatter, the further the smear, the less dense the blood stain. And if the object was stationary, sometimes an imprint of the original object can be left on the secondary source, such as fingerprints, pattern of the material, and also fibres. Number 5. Projected pattern, sometimes called arterial spray. This is caused by pressurised blood discharging from a tear or a rupture in one of the body's main arteries, either the carotid, radial, femoral, brachial, temporal, and the aorta. Although spray from the aorta is less likely owing to its position in the chest cavity. Like impact spatter, the distance from the victim to the surface is defined by the size and density of the blood droplets in the scatter pattern. But with the ruptured artery still pumping blood at high pressure, the impact spatter will be expelled in episodic bursts, which will continue well after the victim has either ran, fallen, or been moved, with the amount of blood dependent on the size of the wound. Number 6. Pool stains. These occur when blood accumulates onto a surface from a wound or ruptured artery, forming a pool of blood. If they have accumulated and formed satellite stains, smaller droplets which have splashed outside of the pool, or have created a trough-like shape in the centre of the pool, this can suggest that blood has dripped steadily and continually from a height, whereas a flat accumulation suggests that they dropped from a lower height, and an unusual void in the blood pool can suggest that the victim was motionless when they were bleeding, but has since moved or has been moved. The quantity of the blood can also suggest how much blood was lost and whether they were alive or dead at the time. Number 7. Insect stains. For flies, a crime scene is like a buffet, and as they feed on the blood and human tissue, they all excrete small circular stains, which appear to be blood spots, but are actually regurgitation and excretion of food, also known as fly speck. Fly speck and the presence of insects can help determine a time of death, as a fly's biology is as accurate as physics. And finally, number 8. Expiration stains. These occur when the victim has an injury to his or her mouth, lungs, or respiratory tract, and being diluted by saliva and mucus, they are expelled from the mouth as a fine mist. But unlike impact spatter, they can only be seen if the victim's mouth or nose is on or near another surface. Expiration stains can help determine if and when a victim was last alive. Of course, if I was ever murdered, the forensic investigator could easily see where I was by simply following a steady trail of cakey crumbs, chocolate sprinkles, broken bits of biscuits, and a sprinkling of sticky fingers as I rhythmically dip my dainty digits into an oversized pot of Nutella, which is technically counted as one of my 5 a day, as it's not chocolate, it's hazelnuts. So there. But as I'm 6 weeks into my diet, yes, it's all going well, thank you very much for asking. As I haven't had any biscuits, cakes or chocolate, I'm amazed my body hasn't gone into shock. Right, now, normally, at this point in the show, I'd haul myself out by, hopefully, playing you maybe an advert, if I'm lucky. But usually you hear nothing but air.
Sadly, the Acast lawyer has been in touch with a cease and desist order, and that, from now on, I must represent them in an honest and truthful way. So, I have to read a prepared statement, which has to be approved by their lawyer. This'll be them. Hello, it's Mike.
Hiya, Acast lawyer here.
You're the Acast lawyer?
Yeah.
But I thought you were the sales monkey.
No, we all just sound the same, because cloning us is cheaper than outsourcing. Half of us are byproducts of interbreeding, because of all the Shoreditch orgies we go to. And we knew you'd struggle to think up a different voice for the lawyer, so we thought, sod it.
Acast lawyer, I must say, you sound remarkably like the sales monkey, though.
Oh, no. I don't think we do. You see, that's our IT team.
Aye.
That's finance.
Aye.
That's our sushi chef.
Aye.
Baker.
Aye.
Barista.
Aye.
Dildo sculptress.
Aye.
In-house hitman.
Aye.
Kimono tailor.
Aye.
Jacuzzi warmer-upper.
Aye.
Sex slave washer.
Aye.
Cocaine carrier.
Aye.
And head of marketing.
Aye.
Hang on. Isn't that Bernard Manning, the racist comedian?
Yeah. He's shit at marketing. But his jokes about the chinkies are dead funny. Wrong, but funny.
But isn't he dead?
Yeah. We reanimated his corpse using the marketing budget for the year.
Here's one. How many blacks does it take to change a light bulb?
Not now, Bernard. We got legal stuff to do. So, read it out, Mark.
Mike.
Whatevs.
Okay. I, Mark, the bitshit host of Insert Name Of Podcast, admits I have been, well, bad-like, saying loads of rude stuff and shit about Acast, and making out like we is right lushes, which we is not.
Very good, Mark. Now say the rest.
Point one. Acast never drink during working hours.
No, we don't. Firstly, we're usually too hungover. B, because we only work 1 hour a day, that's when we normally take lunch. And three, our champagne paddling pool, tequila truck and cocktail slide doesn't open until two. Although, if the DTs have got us well bad, we plug ourselves into the in-house intravenous vodka jelly shot drip.
Aha, I see. Point two. The Acast jacuzzi is not Olympic-sized.
No, it isn't. It's at least triple that. So get your facts right. Besides, no one's even in it right now. Not since the fat lad's pubes jammed the drain after last night's vodka jelly sumo water polo contest. I know, I'm well gutted. I mean, we've still got the cocaine ski slalom and the hooker rodeo derby to play on. But that's like, so uncool.
Here's another one. There's an Englishman, an Irishman, and a...
Not now, Bernard. Save it for when Prince Philip opens our nudie sex slave caviar roller coaster. Anyway, Mark, continue.
Well, I'm glad we're clearing these points up, as I'd hate to make you all seem like fools. Point three. Acast do not abuse the podcasters.
No, we don't. First off, hurling those sad, friendless shitbags at large dartboards isn't cool. It's exercise, and trust me, they need it. Second, how else are we meant to know if the human centipede actually works? Fifthly, they beg us to take part in a real-life game of buckaroo, as the whole Acast team sit on their back, clutching our wages in sacks of gold and our daily ration of cocaine by the kilo, as we whip the podcaster until he collapses, whilst inserting lewd things, like really lewd things, like what we got in Amsterdam, into the place where a prisoner's mobile phone normally goes. And tenthly...
This may take a little while. Just for the sake of the listeners, will there be an advert in this show?
You know, Mark, I don't know.
Aha. Well, let's see.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So, now I'm a free man, enjoying my freedom and breathing London's fresh air. Let's return to our relatively new section, which is called Doing Bird. As you know, I recently spent 6 years as a guest at HMP Soap Drop, Britain's harshest prison, having committed a horrific crime that the arresting officer described as worse than terrorism. As I,
under section 1, paragraph 1, line 1, and word 1 of the Bastards What I Want to Bang Up Act, the sad, bald loser did maliciously state that the pub had run out of Guinness, that maybe I would like a cider.
Once again, officer, I apologise. Hopefully my bones will heal, and I totally agree, it was my fault that I fell down those stairs 8 times. Luckily, my time inside gave me an amazing opportunity to research this bit. But I've had to hold on to it until now, as unlike mini mobile phones, laptops are bigger, squarer, and harder to smuggle in. And the last thing you need when you're writing a blog is sweet corn on the spacebar. Yummy. So this week's question is, how do you maintain a sex life in a UK prison? For those of us who aren't forced to make love to their beautiful girlfriend, Eva Green, on an hourly and sometimes minutely basis. If you are separated from your loved one, maintaining any kind of relationship can be hard, especially the physical part, and especially in a UK prison. Most of the world's prisons have what's known as conjugal visits, where the prisoner's legal spouse, whether wife, husband, or civil partner, is allowed a scheduled period of time, sometimes a few hours, but sometimes as much as a few days, with their loved one in a private part of the prison or an external facility designed for the purpose, where they can get reacquainted with each other, as this increases their chances of returning to an ordinary life after prison. These visits are usually given to low-risk prisoners coming to the end of a long prison sentence. And trust me, when I left Chokey, Eva was on me like a rat of a drainpipe. Many countries allow conjugal visits. In Canada, the prisoner is permitted a 72-hour visit every 3 months, with 48 hours for maximum security prisoners. Obviously, maple syrup and mousses are not provided. In Spain, they are allowed a 3-hour visit every 4 to 8 weeks. Obviously, this is also scheduled around their daily 5-hour mid-afternoon snooze. For Spanish couples held in the same prison, conjugal visits are also allowed every few months, but they only last just 20 minutes. 20 minutes, I know. What will they do for the other 19 minutes? In Belgium, conjugal visits are only allowed for maximum security prisoners if their spouse is also an inmate, or if they are in an open prison. Failing that, most Belgians, whether prisoners or not, just have sex with a waffle. Oh yes, I'm getting in all the stereotypes this week. And no, that's not something I've tried. Yet. In Russia, they're allowed 2 72-hour visits a year. In France, they're allowed 1 72-hour visit a year. And to curb the spread of HIV in prisons, in Zimbabwe, conjugal visits were made legal in 1998. And finally, in Brazil, when they're not too busy playing beach volleyball in skimpy bikinis, conjugal visits are only allowed for male prisoners, whether homosexual or heterosexual, but oddly, not for female convicts. Exactly. Go figure. And yet, conjugal visits in prison are still banned in England, Northern Ireland, Scotland and Wales. And once again, this year, a petition to allow them was rejected by the British government. Well, I guess that means that there's more sex-starved women out there for our Prime Minister, slash head clown, slash chief buffoon, Boris Johnson, to shag. That's when he's not f***ing the rest of us. Am I right? That said, home visits from UK prisons are allowed, as by letting a low-risk prisoner, near the end of a long sentence, return to his or her home, that is actually an incentive to behave well at the end of their sentence, to work hard, and it ingratiates them better back into a normal routine in the real world. Of course, if you're on a 3-day release from prison, would some rumpy-pumpy be the first thing on your mind? Me? No, of course it wouldn't be. For me, I would dive headfirst into a swimming pool filled with rum trifle, using Belgian buns as water wings and Battenberg cakes as flippers. Now that is sex. But what if you're single? Can you have a sex life in prison? Well, yes, you can. And these are my top tips. Number 1. Masturbation. Also known as onerism, self-pollution, making Popeye wink, double-clicking the mouse, throttling the schlong, playing double bass, or flicking the bean. Although it is widely accepted that it occurs in prison, masturbation is not permitted, as with every area, either public, supervised, or even at night, your cell, which you may share, has an observation window on the door. If you are witnessed having some solo love time by another prisoner or a prison guard who can be of either gender, you can be charged with indecent exposure, so masturbation is risky. That said, prison bunkmates often give each other private time by watching the door for each other. And also, there's nothing to stop you having a little pocket shuffle or a quick nip to the loo for a hand shandy. Number 2. Sex aids. Regardless of gender, although this is classified as contraband and not permitted, it is possible for the incarcerated to make their own sex aids in prison. Prisoners have been known to insert their tumescent love trumpets into tubes of Vaseline or jars of warm liver to mimic a lady's rosebud. Obviously, as Vaseline is a petroleum jelly, any ingestion of jelly inside the man's member can cause irritation. And if a lad does insert his prison pecker into a pot of pig's liver, it needs to be drained first of all the fluid, placed inside a tight jar no bigger than the width of the appendage, and heated to no hotter than body temperature, for fear of blistering the bad boy's bell end. For the ladies, or for those who prefer that Mrs. Brown receives a quick visit from Dr. Hardpipe, sex toys can be made by melting handfuls of sticky sweets and reshaping them into a phallic-like object, which is wrapped in cling film, inserting marbles into a condom, hard-boiling some eggs, or pretending you're smuggling a mobile phone into prison. Just make sure it's washed first and afterwards. Number 3. Gay sex. If you're a homosexual man or woman in a same-sex prison, surrounded by prisoners of the same sexual persuasion, a sex life may not be all that complicated. But if you're a heterosexual man in a same-sex prison, it can be difficult unless you decide to be prison gay. Prison gay is a cultural loophole designed to assuage a heterosexual man's sexual needs in a same-sex prison. In prison, a man can get himself a sissy. This is a younger, more effeminate man who may or may not be gay, or could be pre-op, who wears feminine clothes. As his sissy is regarded as a woman, when the two men engage in homosexual sex, to the other prisoners, this does not mean that they are homosexual men. Number 4. Abstinence. A difficult one for any person trapped inside four walls 24 hours a day, for weeks, months, and even years on end, with very little to do. There are prison courses teaching the art of abstinence, but the best method is to keep yourself busy, either by doing sports, hobbies, getting prison duties, or thinking of something boring, like Arsenal.
Under section something-something-do of dissing my beloved Arsenal Act, what is treason, me lad? I sentence you not to prison, but to having your nasty little block knocked off. Or you could just buy me a pint.
And number 5, prostitution. Although this is a criminal offence which threatens their parole, some sex-starved prisoners in UK prisons, who are on ROTL, release on temporary licence, use their day release not to visit their families or friends, but to hook up with a sex worker. It's a big risk, but they do do it. And yet in other prisons, especially around the world, convicts are pimped out while inside, sex workers have been smuggled inside prison, and in the more dangerous Colombian prisons, which are ran by the prisoners and not by the guards, they have brothels full of female sex workers inside a male-only prison. So you can, of course, have a sex life inside a UK prison. If you don't mind marbles up your chuff, your dick inside a dead pig's intestines, and a strictly non-gay pink flesh parcel in your backdoor letterbox. But the easiest way to maintain a normal sex life is simply to stay out of prison. And then you can beat one off to your heart's content. Ah, great days. What's that plopping through my letterbox? Is it a request from Acast asking for the dimensions of the rum trifle filled swimming pool I mentioned earlier? Almost certainly. Is it a love letter from the lovely French actress and my weekend girlfriend Audrey Tautou asking when Eva Green is going to naff off so she can get some Mickey loving? To that I just say, we. Is it an angry note from Bob Dylan saying, as Bob's handwriting is as bad as his mumbling, which of course translates as, when will I make a much anticipated return to Minimile? Yes, it is. And Bob, you just did. No. Of course this is
the Dead Letter Drop!
Yes. Each week, I'll read you a rather mundane letter written by a serial killer. This week, we return back to our old friend, Dennis Nielsen. Ah, Dennis. Now, setting aside his crimes, as you'll hear in this letter, Dennis is a rather officious, and he's quite pedantic about those who don't adhere to the rules of the system. As this is quite an interesting insight into Dennis, I'm going to read this into as near as I can an Aberdeen brogue as he had, although it'll probably be shit.
Dear Chellal, thank you for your letter of the 21st of June, which I got yesterday. I guess it was delayed by the prison, as I had received a note from the censors saying that a letter from the media had been stopped. After which, I submitted an official complaint.
Dennis was a former civil servant who worked for the Job Centre, back then it was known as the Labour Exchange, and he was an ardent Labour supporter, a humanitarian, yes I know, and a union rep.
Having commented to the point of exhaustion, over many years, on questions about Killing for Company,
a book by Brian Masters, regarded as the definitive book about Nielsen,
I don't want to engage in endless comments on the subject in a flood of correspondence.
and even from inquirers who were thoughtful enough to show the courtesy of including a self-addressed envelope. Remember, it is only a book, amongst many books. And in this particular case, the Gospel, according to Brian Masters, who has his own interpretations of the core facts.
Ooh, zing! One star for you there, Brian. The letter then returns to discussing Dennis's family history and those famous persons who came from or in or around Fraserburgh in the northeast of Scotland. One being Virginia Woolf, who is a distant relative of Dennis's, composer Edvard Grieg, who like him was half Norwegian, and the supposed king of rock and roll himself, Elvis Presley, whose family had descended from near Fraserburgh.
The musical gene from the northeast has apparently burned with varying degrees of intensity, and my mother could belt out a song with the best of them. And my grandfather, when not wearing himself down, was a toiler of the deep, sang in the male voice choir.
When I first read that line, I thought he said that his grandfather was a toilet of the deep. This actually makes reference to his grandfather being a fisherman, but it could also be an insult, or implies that he's someone who's very good at smuggling things into prison.
This all must be contagious, because while I was in Whitemore Prison in the 1990s, I taught myself to play a little keyboard. I composed around 76 pieces, or kind of new, and I recorded my modest performances.
I bet he wrote some lovely love songs, like The Boy in the Box, Dying to See You, Pork Chops Before I Pork You, and My Purple-Faced Sweetheart.
Oh, I tried to be creative in prison, producing 3 volumes of poetry, acting in a full-length play. I wrote and directed a 32-minute video called Prison Works, a scathing satire on prison policy under the then Home Secretary, Michael Howard,
which I'm sure was a very fair and balanced video.
I also painted some pictures, corresponded regularly, and wrote my autobiographical. I wrote a book about myself. In short, I like to keep productively busy. So since conviction, I have tried to lead a good and useful life. And because of the seriousness of my crimes, I have never, and will never, buck for release. That's what it's meant to say. Even though repentant, I am a believer in the concepts of justice. I am in relatively good health. Although I smoke, I am not on any kind of medication. So I soldier on as best that I can.
All right, boyo, I can Welsh. Regards, Des.
As you can tell by Dennis's accent there, he had lots of holidays, mostly in Scotland, but he also went to Ireland, Germany. Sometimes he went to Jamaica. It also sounded like he went to India there as well. But that was Dennis's accent. That was accurate. That was 100% accurate-ish. So thank you, Dennis. And now for
True Crime Swapsy Time,
where each week I share with you another true crime podcast, which you might like or might not like. The choice is yours. Here's a clip.
Hiya, Bobby Walthamstow here. Star of such low-rent TV dross as Clap Clinic Slappers, Bingo Wings Dance Floor Deadbeats, and 6 Desperate Attention-Seeking Wankers on Ice. Anyways, this is me very own true crime podcast called Bobby Walthamstow's Celebrity Murder Bandwagon! Yay! Yes, I'm abusing my minor celebrity status, calling in all of my celebrity friends, and riding on the back of a popular genre, because I can't be arsed with doing all the hard work. Each week, I'll interview a series of D-list nobodies, E-list actors, F-list comedians, and G-cup slappers, who waffle on about murders we know nowt about, only for me pals to shamelessly plug whatever shite they're appearing in this week. Which, let's be honest, is probably Panto. Across a series of 3 episodes, if it's shite, or as many as it takes to turn into a TV series, I, Bobby Walthamstow, will interview my great celebrity friends, who you'll also hear on several other podcasts that week, because they're desperate. They include Freddie Scunthorpe.
Look at me, I'm a right numpty-doo.
Sassy McFlaps. Oh, me chuff's peeping out. I'm so naughty. And pouty Philomena Quinoa Falafel. Who admittedly was a bad choice for a podcast. In my podcast shows, I'll ask these vacuous deadbeats such searing questions as, Freddie, what would be the most unexpected way for you to die? Sassy, how often do you check the brakes on your car? And Pouty, apart from shame, do you have any other life-threatening allergies? And other such insightful questions about their piss-poor careers and the hypothetical death of D-list pieces of shite who nobody is gonna miss. This is Bobby Walthamstow's Celebrity Murder Bandwagon, and trust me, I am all there.
Oddly, even though it's utter drivel, Bobby's podcast actually proved to be a roaring success. As shortly after the first episode, his guest and TV rival, Freddie Scunthorpe, tragically died. After he got his unusually small size 2 shoe stuck in a buckled drain outside of his unlit house, as he was doing a 4:30 a.m. run, just as an abandoned bin lorry with a dodgy handbrake accidentally ran him over 5 times. Bobby was planning to attend Freddie's funeral, but as he was offered a TV deal off the back of the podcast success, but mostly Freddie's death, instead he sent him a bouquet of flowers in the shape of a mid-digit. Apparently, this was a private joke between them. And now, on to the final section of Mini Mile, an almost newish bit which I'm calling London Weirdos.
Alright, mate. Alright, geezer. I hear your cracker is missing its cheese. Yeah, mate, I'm right off me rocker. Even the hospital doc says I'm not just a loony, I'm a natter. Lovely jabbly, come on in. Just don't wipe your arse on me carpet.
This week, I shall entertain you with a little story about a priest, a man of God, one of the Lord's representatives on earth, who is holier than thou and can never do no wrong. Or so we are told. Don't worry, this is not a story about another paedophile priest, or another celibate bishop who got his cleaner up the duff, or a staunchly homophobic vicar who was found in a public loo with someone who wasn't gay as such, but was probably just prison gay. No. This is a very different kind of priest. In 2016, Church of England priest, 36-year-old Gareth Jones, who is the vicar of St Mary the Virgin Church in Great Ilford, had been drinking at El Vino and the George on Fleet Street before staggering off to the Borderline nightclub in Soho. Having miraculously turned water into wine, or less miraculously, having turned the contents of his wallet into 3 bottles of wine, several pints of beer, a large selection of gin and tonics, and several vodkas, Gareth had consumed a whopping 53 units of alcohol. As he stumbled down Charing Cross Road, having collapsed in a doorway, when Ian Pollock, a paramedic, gently shook the pissed-up pastor, who was wearing his full vicar attire, Gareth roared, "I'm gonna f*** you up!" and wrestled with the paramedic. Pastor Jones then punched, bit and spat at the paramedic, who was clearly more of a good Samaritan than Gareth was that night, and as a passing police officer held the violent vicar's legs, Gareth barked, "I have diplomatic immunity from the Vatican! You're f***ed!" Even though he's Church of England, which has nothing to do with the Vatican. The cursing Christian was then put in leg straps, placed in the police van, and carted off to Belgravia police station. At Highbury Magistrates Court, Gareth Jones, who had previous convictions for communicating a false bomb hoax, committing an affray, possession of cannabis, fraud, criminal damage and driving offences, all before he was 21, he pleaded guilty to 2 counts of assault by beating and was ordered to pay £700 in fines, £200 compensation to the PC, £200 to the paramedic, as well as £85 prosecution costs and a £35 victim surcharge. Pastor Jones later said, "To say that this incident has been a wake-up call would be an understatement." After his trial, he faced an ecclesiastical court which could have imposed a lifetime ban on him serving the church. But as he turned his life around and quit drinking, He remains the priest of St. Mary's the Virgin Church in Great Ilford. And they say that God works in mysterious ways. So now you know. So, my beloved friends, that was your weekly dose of Mini Mile. I hope it was arousing, nipple-tingling, and orgasmic, but not in a way which involves your winkle being slid into a warm jar of liver, or half a pound of marbles being shoved up your mobile phone pouch. Don't forget, if you fancy taking part in a Murder Mile walk, they run every Sunday at 11 a.m. Tickets are available via my website. A big thank you this week to my new Patreon supporters, who are Gwyn Hughes, as well as all current and ex-patron supporters, and everyone who's left a nice review of Murder Mile on iTunes, Facebook, or your podcast app. It really helps keep the podcast alive. As if kind words contained calories, I would be twice my body weight. Mini Mile returns next week. Until then, love to you all. Tatty bye!
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.